Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. Yesterday, a jury found Richard Satchwell guilty of murdering his wife, Tina. The trial had lasted just over 4 weeks. Tina Satchwell had disappeared in early 2017, but 6.5 years had passed before Gardaí discovered her body. She'd been buried under the stairs in the couple's living room. RTÉ's southern correspondent Pascal Sheehy spoke to Rachel on the News at One, and he talked about the various interviews he had conducted with Richard Satchwell over the years. Years during which Satchwell had expressed sorrow at his wife's disappearance.
Pascal, will you bring us back to your first meeting with Satchwell? What do you remember?
I can't quite remember when was the first time I met him, but I do distinctly remember, I will never forget the first time I interviewed him. And that interview was the first interview that was played to the jury at the beginning of this murder trial around 4 weeks ago. It was the 26th of June 2017. It was exactly 14 weeks to the day on which Tina Satchwell went missing. And I met Richard Satchwell at his home. He invited myself and my cameraman, Martin Hartnett, into the front room of the house. And he spoke very freely then about how much he missed. He expressed deep sadness and anguish at the disappearance of Tina. And in a way, it was very convincing. But in another way, it was very disquieting in a way that just gave me a bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. That's the only way I can describe it. I would be, under normal circumstances as well, extremely reluctant to describe the physical setting of the house at that time. But it was just in such bad condition. There were animals roaming around the house. There was dog feces on the ground, I remember, and we just discussed it in the past week how Martin Hartnett, the cameraman, nearly came a cropper when he slipped in the hallway on dog feces on the way out. We really couldn't wait to get out of there. And the interview that we did, we did it across the road a few minutes later on the old pier in Youghal. And again, Richard Satchwell recounted how much he was missing his wife. But in a way, he turned it around to be about himself. And I think we can hear some of that now.
To me, she's the most amazing person that I've ever come across. I'm just getting more and more worried. I'm finding it more difficult to sleep. I'm losing weight with worry, struggling to eat. And I just know somebody out there has to know something.
The voice of Richard Satchwell, who was found guilty yesterday of murdering his wife, Tina. On Wednesday's Liveline, the atrocities and horror of the war in Gaza was brought very close to home. Sligo-based Dr. Ali Al-Najjar spoke to Joe about his sister Ala's loss. Last Friday, 9 out of 10 of her children were killed in an Israeli airstrike. Dr. Najjar was with his brother in Saudi Arabia when he learned of what had happened.
So I was sitting next to my brother, and suddenly he was watching a video. I heard the voice. I recognized Ala's voice in that video. So I jumped in immediately and looked at the horrible picture of charred bodies being pulled out from the rubble. And those were her kids. That was the video that was filmed by the civil defense, where I can see Ali Yahya, the brother of Hamdi, is talking to Ala and telling her, go back, go back. And she saw the body of one of her kids. And I heard her voice saying, Hayati, which means my darling, my love.
And this was a large family who'd minded each other, especially when their parents, both doctors, were working.
Whenever you talk to her, if she's at home, you will hear the noise of the kids.
Yeah.
It's a house full of joy, full of life. She will be giving instruction. Oh, Eve, please don't do that to Rakan. Oh, Yahya, look after Sidar.
Yeah.
lots of actions are in the background whenever you talk to her, of course. And most of our talks will be all about my kids, her kids. And I always ask her and actually try to learn from her. How can you look after 10? I am barely able to manage with the two that I have. I have asked her that question many times, but I don't know, in the most humble and she simplifies it as if it is not a big deal somehow. Because she's resilient. She told me, believe it or not, the older your oldest become, the more you can rely on them on him in terms of looking after the young ones. So Yahya was always looking after the infants, holding them, changing their diapers, feeding them with bottles. Hala will express milk while she's in duty, and when she returns back, she will give them the. Oh my God. I remembered when Ala was talking about the last bottle of breast milk she expressed. So she gives that to Yahya. Yahya looks after the infants. And you know, when you have 10 kids, there will be different personalities.
Yeah.
Rakan will always be with Eve, and you know, Lokman will be with Sadeen, or you know, they will have their own mates among themselves, you know.
Yeah.
Just one of Ala's children, 11-year-old Adan, and her husband Hamdi survived the attack. Both father and son are severely wounded. Their home is destroyed and they're living in the hospital.
What's communication been like in the last week, Dr. Ah?
Oh, it's horrible. It's desperate. She has a phone that belongs to one of our cousins.
Okay.
I can't communicate with her through WhatsApp. It's only through direct phone calls on that number. So finally, we get to the number that we can call directly. I was just talking to her a couple of hours ago, just checking with her what's the update on Hamdi's situation and Adam. Yeah, Ala is probably the most resilient person I've ever met.
He told Joe what action he hoped might come from this that might end the killing in Gaza.
And Dr. Al, there's been so much loss. Do you feel the world is, and we're getting it through your human story, but do you feel the world is truly seeing the reality on the ground, especially for families like yours?
We have to give credit to all the good souls in this world. There are plenty of courage voices, starting from the Jewish community itself. Lots of Jews have been pointing toward what's happening and looking at the Palestinian lives as lives of equivalent human being, like let's say the voices of Gideon Levy, for example, Ilan Pape, Maxwell Blumenthal, many others. When I hear them, especially among Israeli themselves, that they are appreciating the suffer that we go through, although those are minority, but having those voices give me hope in this world that one day this nightmare will end. I've been deeply touched by the support that I've received in Ireland here. Not a single person haven't shown me empathy and support. I follow the media, I read the news, and I see regularly videos of huge protests across the world. Obviously, a lot of work and effort has been done already, but then you ask yourself, why is it not enough to end this nightmare?
Yeah.
I mean, at the level of the street, I've felt the pulse of the street. But at the level of governments, why are we not doing enough? Why we are not imposing enough pressure to stop this madness?
From Liveline on Wednesday. And needless to say, Gaza was discussed in the Dáil. Late debate brought us this exchange between independent TD Catherine Connolly and Taoiseach Simon Harris.
We are a small country. It's time that we led, given our history. It's time we called for an absolute ceasefire, led in the UN, and make our words mean something and call out the narrative for what it is. And the narrative is Israel is a rogue state. It is not a democratic state. How dare you shake your head? You stand up.
You have to conclude,
stand
Deputy
up,
Connolly.
Stand up and account for what we're going to do when you say
Deputy
there are war
Connolly,
crimes and
conclude.
A genocide.
Taoiseach.
So
You have such vitriolic dislike for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil that you cannot ever actually come above and rise to the moment. We are the first government in the European Union to say what Israel is doing is genocide. Do you hear that, Deputy? It is genocide.
What are you going to do about it? And we're going to pass
the occupied Palestinian territory.
We're going to pass it as quickly as possible.
It's going to go to the Foreign Affairs Committee in the month of June. While you're standing here just throwing brickbats at me, we're working to support the people of Palestine. And the only chamber I ever go into in the entire world where people don't acknowledge that Ireland, the government, the people of Ireland are standing with the people of Palestine, standing up for human rights, standing up for international law, is here when you get up and distort with your ideology the actions of this government.
Ooh, joining Gollum, Louise Byrne, political correspondent for the Irish Mirror.
A clearly irked Taoiseach there. Whatever it was about that particular exchange, Louise, it pretty fairly got under his skin. But his use of the term genocide, had you heard him say it as explicitly before this?
No, today, and it has been confirmed, today was the first time that he used that term. He was in the Shannon this morning and he used it, and he used it again in Thull this afternoon. Micheál Martin used it for the first time yesterday as well. So keeping a lockstep there in competition, others might say.
And she also referenced President Michael D. Higgins' defence of Ireland's stance on Gaza.
You heard Michael D. Higgins talking about it at Bloom today. Like, any time Ireland says anything about Israel, they are called anti-Semitic, which he called a slander and a disgrace. And he was saying, Taoiseach was saying that, you know, any time they do anything, the opposition says it's not enough, and the government is saying, well, we're doing our best. And it kind of really symbolises, I think, the ongoing discussion about Gaza and the Dáil at the moment.
All right.
From late debate, but negotiations to end nearly 20 months of war have so far failed to achieve a lasting breakthrough. Yesterday, Claire put this to Lise Doucette, BBC News Chief International Correspondent.
Just on the issue of hostages, because Benjamin Netanyahu in a public statement during the week said he didn't believe that Hamas would hand back all of the hostages, the living and the dead. And he said, until that happens, we will remain in Gaza. What are you learning about these various texts and what they say about the hostage handovers?
The families of the hostages, and there's said to be 58 left, only, we understand, according to what Prime Minister Netanyahu said on Monday, only 20 now are believed to be alive. The families don't believe Prime Minister Netanyahu. He just had a meeting with one of the groups of hostages, and in the Israeli media this morning, they're saying they left, you know, believing that bringing the hostages home is not a key war aim of Prime Minister Netanyahu. The mediators, Qatar and Egypt, Hamas officials themselves, have repeatedly said they are ready to give all the hostages back, all of the hostages back in one fell swoop for an end to the war. The difficulty is that Prime Minister Netanyahu and his allies, most of all the right-wing ministers this morning who are calling on Israel to use, in the words of one of them, full force to kill every last member of Hamas. For them, they want the hostages to come home, but they don't want to end the war. For them, the end of the war equals the end of Hamas. And even though for more than a year now, senior Israeli military officers, including the former defense minister, who ended up falling out with the prime minister, said that we have done as much as we can when it comes to military action. We should do a deal to bring the hostages home because it is only through negotiations that we can bring them home. And that is factually the case. But Prime Minister Netanyahu still says that Hamas has still not been destroyed. And it is true. There still are Hamas fighters, but their network has been broken down. They are devastated militarily, but they still have a political shape. And Prime Minister Netanyahu is arguing that they should give up their arms, the leadership should leave. And of course, behind all this is Prime Minister Netanyahu says, I agree with President Trump that all the Palestinians should leave Gaza. They say voluntarily, but it will not be voluntarily. And we will set up what President Trump calls a freedom zone. It's a major property development.
And on Morning Ireland, Tom Fletcher, Under Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator at the UN, joined Mary, and he talked about the situation for the people left in Gaza.
As you've seen from those clips of people desperate for food, you know, they'll do anything now to feed their children.
Is this a forced starvation of people?
Well, what we're seeing is a deliberate blockade that lasted 80 days. We've now had 10, 11 days where, in theory, we've been able to get aid in, but it's a trickle. It's a drop in the ocean of what's needed. We're talking about a few hundred trucks at best. And during the ceasefire, when we were able to operate, still with restrictions, we were getting in 600, 700 trucks every day. You know, we have 180,000 pallets of food at the border ready to go in. That could feed all the civilians in Gaza for several months, and we can't get it in. So Gaza's the hungriest place on earth right now.
From Morning Ireland, back in a bit. Welcome back. Points for you, gentle listener, if you can recognise this very, very happy bridesmaid.
Oh, there he is. Rob, this is Kate, my maid of honour. Kate, this is Rob, the future Mr. Sharon Morris.
Oh, great to meet you, Kate.
Sharon, can I just talk to you for a moment?
I'm so happy to finally meet you.
It's great to meet you.
You know, you got a good one here. Even if you hadn't gotten her pregnant, she'd be a catch. we are going to have a legendary week. You know, my first time away from the kids in 5 years. I don't miss them.
Oh yes, the amazing Eileen Walsh playing Kate in Sharon Horgan's catastrophe. Child-free, falling over with the glee of it all. But Walsh is taking on a different role for Cork's Midsummer Festival. It's called The Second Woman. One scene performed 100 times opposite 100 different actors. Oh yeah, and in just 24 hours.
What mad pill were you taking that day when you said, I'd love to do that?
Come on, I'll give it a go.
Damn straight. Explain yourself.
There's 3 pages of dialogue and direction. Mm. The scene opens with an opportunity for the participant to say something that will be different, and I can respond to that. And then there's 2 pages of dialogue that are very much stuck to, but that includes getting a drink, eating some noodles and having a little discussion about trying to win him
props
back.
Props and business and
everything. I know. And then we share a kind of an intimate dance moment.
Okay, but you have 100 different actors coming out over this 24-hour period. How long is the scene? Is it about 10
minutes?
It's
about 7 minutes.
7 minutes, okay.
Yeah.
So that's about, what is it, 4 or 5 an hour? 5?
Yeah.
6?
And then you've got like
7
a brief,
maybe.
Yeah, you've got a brief few minutes at the end of each hour to reset props, drinking glasses, you know, if your makeup is smudged or, you know, quick little checks.
And the actor, does he come out with set lines or, you know, is he allowed to...
He has a brief kind of, there's a slight looseness around the beginning of it. So that
the opening section,
they can choose.
They can say whatever they want.
Yeah. You know, because perhaps they might want to say, look, as your father, they might want to distance themselves and not do a romantic scene. Yeah. So that's okay too. And then at the end, they get to choose to leave on a positive or a negative.
Sounds really interesting. And as an audience member, you can hop in or you can stay for the whole 24 hours, should you have the stamina. Speaking of which...
How the hell am I going to get through this?
It's just, it's the 24 hours aspect of it that kind of...
Yeah,
I see,
but there's something kind of wonderful about that because, again, you can't prepare for it. But I'm kind of thrilled at that, at the idea of... What will happen after that? Once you start getting tired, what happens after that? And how does that affect the performance? And maybe you will be really tired and maybe the men will have to carry you a little bit.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting.
From Arena. And continuing in what we will call our lovey section, said with love, one of the Cusack acting dynasty, Sarah Cusack, joined Oliver. She's coming to the stage in Escaped Alone by Carol Churchill. And yes, steeped in the theatre. But her father, Cyril Cusack, well, not always the easiest.
All of the interviews that various Cusacks have said, have given about your dad, the euphemism difficult is used, and like we as Irish people read into it going, oh, he was a horror.
You're far too perspicuous, aren't you?
I'm just reading between the lines everybody else would do.
But he was tricky.
He was tricky.
He was tricky, yeah. He was great when we were tiny, but as soon as we could answer back, That was the end of the road, really.
He liked to be the boss then, I presume.
Oh, for sure. And I think because he had no... he hadn't experienced family life. He kind of wanted to create a rather Victorian arrangement.
I see.
Which he just chose the wrong offspring for that.
But she knew her father was a brilliant actor. Although there was this infamous incident.
I mean, he had a bad experience in London and was banned.
Yeah, that was just for being, was he tipsy on stage? Which was totally out of character.
Well, they had to bring down the curtain. And he was playing opposite Vivian Leigh, who had just made Gone with the Wind. So he was at the absolute pinnacle of his career, really.
And he was trashed in the press over there.
Well, the thing is, they had to bring down the curtain, and it isn't really. It was St. Patrick's Day, and he'd gone to some, you know, shindig at the embassy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And people said, you can't go on. And he said he could.
Gosh.
And then, as far as I understand, he spoke gobbledygook and they had to bring the curtain down.
Which again, he was such a professional.
Yeah.
It was just completely... But that was a devastating moment in his life, wasn't it?
Yeah, because he didn't work in England then for decades. But he took himself off to Hollywood and made a very, very impressive film career there.
But you can't escape the old family dynamics, even or maybe especially when you act together.
I worked with them certainly twice. But again... Tricky.
Is that another euphemism?
Well, the thing is, he was so good. And I said, we were doing Three Sisters. And I said, Cyril, can you, you know, at the beginning, Olga has this long thing, really a bit of background for the audience. And I said, can you kind of not be so busy upstage? And he said, well, I'm just, you know, I'm doing what you would do. I see Rina and I blow her a kiss and I see the flowers on the table and I think, oh, spring is here. I said, yeah.
So it's your line and he's drawing attention at the back.
Yeah, what Chekhov says.
Chekhov.
And I said, no. Chekhov says, he comes in, sits down and reads the paper. That's what Chekhov says. And he said, well, I think it's because I'm in Ireland. People say, oh, that's Cyril up at the back. So I can't help it.
Sarha Cusack with Oliver. And with Brendan at the weekend, Bono, yes, Bono. And his Stories of Surrender is a new documentary based on his one-man show. And his relationship to his late father, Bob, well, it's a big presence.
One thing that people will notice about this film, and there is not an insult buried in this, your voice is the best it's been in years, I would say. It's strong, it's sweet, it's soulful, it's totally in control.
Well, thank you for saying that. The reason for continuing in U2, each of us has to answer why we would want to take U2 further. For me, it was the sense that my voice, that I was coming into my voice rather than looking back at it. And that I was getting to this place where these songs were really starting to sing me, as we say. You know, it's just, I never thought of myself really as a singer in that sense. It was more of a shouter, came in through punk rock. And, you know, I say at one point, it's a sort of, it's not very scientific to suggest that my father gave me this gift in passing of an actual tenor voice. But something changed in me, in my relationship with him, that allowed me to be less uptight and as a person. And I think that's where the singing comes from. The instrument is working very well, and I'm kind of reverent about it myself. I'm like, wow.
And he also talked about their stint in Vegas at the Sphere. U2, yes. But a U2 without Larry.
So Larry's the only one of you who's ever had to go to a U2 gig and watch it, which he did in the Sphere. And look, I know Bram was great and all that, but you're among your own now. Was it weird for the three of you? Was it weird for Larry not being there? Was that something he had to work through?
Yeah. Yes.
Like, it's his band, right?
As he will continually remind anyone who walks past him in the street, I started you too. But he was very encouraging of Bram, very generous to Bram. And but yeah, that was a real challenge for us. People say when four members of the U2 walk out on stage that the hairs go up on the back of their neck. Even people who don't know the band that well, they've just come along as guests. They go, "What is that feeling?" And I sometimes explain to people if I see them later, I say, that happens to us. It's the strangest thing. It's just, we walk out, something is going off. Chemistry, whatever it is.
So was it different without Larry?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was hard for Larry to turn up and not be playing. But he did. He faced his fear with some grace.
And while Bono the frontman is one thing, Bono the activist, the agitator, that's another. And more recently, he was criticised for not using his platform to speak out more on Gaza. Brendan put this to him.
You got some criticism for accepting the Medal of Freedom from Joe Biden last year in light of how America was supporting Israel's actions in Gaza. Like, when you look back on that now, do you think maybe was it wrong at this time to take that from America?
Being a conscientious objector with somebody else's conscience is quite a stretch. I've worked with Joe Biden for 25 years. I worked with him when he was in the Senate on Drop the Debt. I've worked with him on universal access to antiretroviral drugs, on increasing aid flows. This is a man who I have deep respect for and a real relationship with. And, you know, there's other aspects to that which are just inaccurate and just people just not understanding that these bills, you know the supplies for Israel and their weapons were bound up in Ukraine's defense. In fact, there was attempts to decouple them, but Biden knew he wouldn't get it through Congress. He wouldn't get Ukraine through Congress. These are complex affairs. And I should be flattered, and I am grateful that people expect such a lot of me. But I've been doing this for 25 years, and anyone who thinks that I'm not, you know, shocked and appalled by what's going on in Gaza and the children of Gaza. You spoke
very movingly about children in the rubble of our revenge.
And this was a wide-ranging interview that covered a lot. But this was how it finished up.
You talk in the show, in the film, about the dysfunction of wanting to be great at something. How you might not want to give up the emptiness that gave you everything, and how even for years, even when you were at home, you weren't home. Are you better at that now? Do you still sacrifice all to the dysfunction, or when you're home now, are you home?
I am very clear about the most important thing in my life is my family. You two is an extension of that, but it is not that. They're a different kind of family. I went in search of alternate families. You know, even the One campaign or Red, they're all bands, aren't they?
Yeah.
And you kind of, you know, I ran away to join the circus, but you know, the circus was just another family. And I'm grateful to them. So grateful to my mates, but no. Ali's at the center of my universe as long as she let me be. And yeah.
Hey, Bono, what would Bob, your dad, have said about this film?
Ah, that's a... I think we've enough Bono by now, he'd say. Have we really? I think we might have enough. Would you mind? And no more songs about your dead ma, your dead da, you know. the north of Ireland, Africa. Just get over the tragedy, get into the comedy, would you? Give us all a break. I think that'd be
okay.
I think that'd be Bob's.
Bono, thank you so much.
Back in a bit. Welcome back. Joe Duffy, loosening the tie and getting very curious about Metallica.
You have a Metallica drumstick.
I do, and I have a pick.
Okay. And what's your favourite album?
Saint Anger.
Okay. This is Metallica, Master of Puppets. Here they come with rip-roaring sound, rip-roaring electric sound. Letty. That's called Master of Puppets. Letty.
It is. It was used in Stranger Things in their most recent season.
Okay. And just for people like myself who couldn't make out the lyrics of Master of Puppets, they were as follows. End of passion play, crumbling away, I'm your source of self-destruction. Veins that pump with fear, sucking dark, it's clear. Leading on your death's construction. Taste me, you will see. More is all you need. Dedicated. How I'm come crawling faster. Obey your master. It's not exactly Seamus Heaney, is it?
Joe. And you a massive metal fan. On Mooney Goes Wild, caving. An absolute nightmare for some of us. For others, massive adventure.
The place to find really big new caves was in remote parts of the world, like in Borneo or in the highlands of New Guinea or China. Cave entrances hidden in thick rainforest. We'd have to have camps in rainforest for maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks. Some of these caves are massive, terribly exciting, because you know your light was the first light that ever been shone in these incredible big passages and stalactites and underground rivers.
That's Pam Fogg. She and her husband Tim took Michelle Brown right underground to White Father's Cave in County Cavan.
Okay, so we've come in now. We've come in along the passage around about 30 or 40 metres into a big chamber, but getting here meant wading up to our knees and above, so we're a little bit damp now we're in here. And we've got into a big chamber, and you can hear there's a little bit of a waterfall going down there, and then the passage is continuing off in the distance. So this is the biggest chamber in White Father's. It's a lovely place, but we're right away from daylight now. And if we were to turn off our lights, this is pure blackness. You will see no light in here. Unless we bring light in here, there never is light in here. So this is your proper cave blackness, velvety blackness.
Ooh, scary. And it is not for the faint of heart or the amateur enthusiast. It's dangerous. And you really need to know what you're doing. So be warned. And if that wasn't enough for you, they are in the company of a newly discovered species, the zombie spider.
The zombie spider bit is it appears that this fungi actually influences the behaviour of the animals that they parasitise, which is extraordinary because it hasn't got a brain, but there's a central nervous system in the things that they take over, and they make them do things, which is extraordinary.
Like dopamine, is it?
Dopamine is the idea, yeah. So it's a chemical, a happy chemical, not so happy for the spiders, unfortunately, but in this case, it seems to make the spiders come out of the cracks and get into their webs more than they do normally. So they expose themselves more to the drafts that run through the cave, and that shifts the spores of the fungi, which is to the advance of the fungi. It's a fascinating story, and it's extraordinary that a fungi can influence an insect's behaviour.
From Mooney Goes Wild. A new from the Doc on One, Stolen Sister. It focuses on one of the worst crimes committed in Ireland, the murders of Elizabeth Plunkett and Mary Duffy in 1976.
23-year-old Elizabeth Plunkett heads off for a night away with friends.
It's the summer of 1976, the best summer we've had for years.
Just hours later, she is kidnapped by two men in British Bay.
These are two career criminals wanted for rape in Britain.
They are Ireland's first serial killers. While both men confess to Elizabeth's murder, no one is ever convicted. How could this happen?
We're being denied any sort of justice.
Now, this is a six-part podcast, which will also be broadcast on Friday evenings on RT Radio 1. But almost 50 years after her murder, why did the family of Elizabeth Plunkett contact the Doc on One team? Producer Nicolene Greer joined Claire Byrne.
The podcast began, I suppose, for us last year when Elizabeth's two sisters, Bernie and Kathleen, came to the Doc on One and asked us, would we be interested in hearing their story? And they thought really long and hard about whether or not they would come to us and go public, because for almost 50 years, the family has never actually spoken publicly about this. They just said, we'll let it lie. But they just felt now that they had to speak out on behalf of Elizabeth, out of duty for her. And they were very nervous coming to us. But the reason that they came to us was because in 2023, the Plunkett family was approached by the parole board. So as you mentioned, Geoffrey Evans died in prison in 2012, and Shaw is in prison as the longest serving prisoner in Ireland. But he had applied for parole. And as part of the parole process now, families are invited to make a submission to give, you know, whether they think somebody should be released or not. And so Bernie and Kathleen decided to do that as a family. It was a really difficult thing for them to do. They'd both been teenagers when this happened, and so many emotions had been buried, and they were bringing all of that up again. And it was a really difficult and emotional process for them to go through to do that. But they felt this was something
they had to do. It.
And then a few weeks after that, they actually were contacted again through their solicitor to say, we're really sorry, there's been an error, and John Shaw was never actually convicted for murdering Elizabeth Plunkett.
So his conviction was in relation to the other case?
Yes, so it was for the crimes against Mary Duffy.
So they are really hoping for some answers in relation to all of that.
Answers and more. Stolen Sister from the Doc on One. On Sunday night, Zoe Cummins presented The Prompt. Writers were asked to respond to, well, a prompt. And this week's guest writer setting said prompt was Mike McCormack.
The patron saint of, why did it go that direction?
It sprung to mind immediately, actually. I didn't have to do too much thinking about it because I'd recently come across a list of saints. And I had come across things like, you know, we all know that this is a saint, patron saint of lost causes and the patron saint of this, that, the next thing. And I come across one which said that St. Nicholas was the patron saint of girls with small dowries. And I was, and I thought, how specific is that? What a niche remit that is. And then it began, it kind of dawned on me, well, there could be a patron saint of anything. There could be a patron saint of fire engines. There's probably a patron saint of spacemen. I know that there's a patron saint of television out there somewhere. That. So I decided to, okay, let's run with that. Let's go with that as an overall kind of a rubric or a prompt and see where it leads us.
To Madonna, a living saint, let's face it. And this story from Colin McAuliffe.
I was almost seven and entering my Madonna phase. The three of us bonded over Like a Prayer, which was topping the charts at the time. While my mother had indicated a certain indignation over the lyrical content, Father Ryan assured her that it was all above board, and Madonna's faith was indeed quite sincere. I let on that I, too, had initially struggled with the song, but after some intense reflection, was happy to confirm the priest's hypothesis.
And that was just the start of it. Once you're a Madonna fan, you're in for life. From The Prompt. Again, more points if you can work out what links these songs. Oh yeah, we're all about the points this week. Darcy's Friday offering, but not their usual wheeling in the ears. Listen up.
Chance to blow. This opportunity comes once in a lifetime.
8 Mile High, Lose Yourself, Eminem. This is Jai Ho from Slumdog Millionaire. Tambi Shah, 2008. Now one of the greats.
Am I a man or am I a Muppet?
Am I a Muppet?
If I'm a Muppet, then I'm a very manly Muppet.
Very manly Muppet.
Am I a Muppet? If I'm a man, that makes me a Muppet of a man.
Jason Segel from the Muppet movie, 2011. A Star is Born, V2.
I'm of the deep, I watch as I dive in. I'll never meet the ground. Crash through the surface when they can't hurt us. We'll fall from the shallow now. In the shallow.
Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, 2018. Music from Barbie, Billie Eilish.
What was I made for? Taking a drive. I was an ideal. Not so alive. Turns out I'm not real. Just something you paid for.
Did you guess? I'm sure you did. They were all Oscar-winning songs from films. And that brings us to the end of this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week, and we will finish with Falling Slowly from Glenn Hansard and Marketa Urglova. Yep, an Oscar winner.